When Robert was growing up, networks were, for the most part, private laboratories used by computer scientists who were experimenting with new ways of using computers. The things he observed his father do, and the research he heard and learned about, served only to reinforce that perception. But the world was changing rapidly, and the most powerful instrument of change over the next decade was the ARPANET. Its name derives from ARPA, the Pentagon's Advanced Research Projects Agency, which was renamed Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency during the 1970s. This agency was run by scientists rather than soldiers, and it was charged with exploring high-risk ideas. For American computer science in university and corporate research centers, DARPA created an entirely new world. During the 1960s and the 1970s, DARPA funding was crucial to the most significant advances in computer science. Personal computers, networks, artificial intelligence, and voice recognition, all in one way or another, were the fruit of DARPA-funded experiments. The ARPA network, in turn, was the brainchild of a community of computer scientists who, during the late 1960s, were among the first to envision permitting scientists and engineers to share computers and expensive resources instantly and easily, no matter where they were. That a computer network could serve as both a means for instantaneous communication among researchers and an experimental communications laboratory was a revolutionary notion. At the beginning of the 1960s, Paul Baran, a scientist at the RAND Corporation, was searching for a way to make telephone networks more reliable in the event of a nuclear war. Out of his research came the idea of breaking digitized messages up into packets of numbers. Each packet would carry an electronic address, and each could be routed by the most efficient route. Packet switching dramatically lowered the cost of data communications, making low-cost computer networks possible. The notion of actually linking computers to share these networks came from J.C. R. Licklider, a psychologist who went on to become the first director of DARPA's Information Processing and Technology Office. The original ARPANET was built around separate message-passing computers known as Interface Messaging Processors, or IMPs, which were the backbone of the network. Later, small computers known as TIPs, Terminal Interface Processors, which handled connections with slow dial-up terminals, were added. Each of the IMPs would be connected to another IMP on a leased phone line and was capable of sending and receiving at what then seemed like an extremely high speed. Contemporary networks routinely carry data at 20 times that speed, and network designers are working to build a national data highway that would increase the speed of today's fastest commercial links by up to 700 times. The first ARPANET node was installed at the University of California at Los Angeles in late 1969, and the next three nodes were placed at the University of California at Santa Barbara, Stanford Research Institute, a California think tank, and the University of Utah. The next year, three more nodes were added on the East Coast, at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Bolt, Baranek, and Newman, the Cambridge, Massachusetts think tank that designed the ARPANET network, and Harvard University. Other research projects had linked computers experimentally, but the ARPANET was to grow into the first nationwide computer network. The ARPANET connected research centers, military sites, and universities. Initially, virtually all of the computers on it were identical. Almost all were digital PDP-10s, and virtually all of the people at those sites were government-funded computer science researchers. By 1973, the ARPANET consisted of 25 machines. To be at a site connected to the ARPANET was to be among an elite. So coveted was a connection to the network that academic job offers were sometimes accepted or turned down on the basis of promised access to the network. For some computer scientists, access to the network was a requirement for doing their jobs. For these scientists, going to a university without a network connection would have been like a research microbiologist accepting a job at a school with no microscopes. In its early days, and even into its middle years, the ARPANET had the feel of a private club. "Are you on the net?" was a question heard among the most elite computer scientists. Getting into the club wasn't easy, but once you were in, you were given free rein. There was no concept whatsoever of security. Anyone anywhere could read a file anywhere in the network. At Carnegie Mellon University, for example, every file on every computer, save those that were explicitly protected, was available for examination or copying by anybody on the ARPANET. Graduate students at those places spent many happy hours cruising around through the files on outside computers to see if there was anything worth reading. In 1975, the operation of the network was turned over to the Defense Communications Agency, a Pentagon organization that is responsible for military voice and data traffic. By then, there were more than 60 sites on the network, and the amount of data traffic carried by ARPANET had increased dramatically. Part of the clubbishness that defined the early ARPANET grew up around the technical limitations of the network. Through the 1970s, the ARPANET could only support 256 computers. But by 1982, a new network addressing scheme was developed to allow for exponential growth of the network. By the mid-1980s, the ARPANET had become the seed for a complex of networks called the Internet, which touched down in more than 50 countries. It was no longer just an engineering experiment. Computer centers used the network for technical support. Researchers sent papers back and forth in an instant, and software of all kinds flowed around the globe. Commercial enterprises adopted the technology of the network to create their own private versions of the network based on the same set of communications protocols. These corporations also used the Internet itself to stay in contact with operations spread around the world. The Internet, in turn, was connected through gateway computers to hundreds or thousands of other networks. Some began to speak of an even broader concept of interconnected networks. They referred to it as the Matrix, taking the name from the all-encompassing computer network in William Gibson's Neuromancer. It was with some indignation that the ARPANET pioneers watched their network be appropriated by society at large. Whereas in the early days it could cost as much as $250,000 a year to maintain a connection to the network, the base of support had since grown to the point where cost was minimal. Universities and corporate research centers still composed most of the links, but by 1988 the function of the network had broadened considerably. The ARPANET was supposed to be primarily a computing laboratory, but mostly it was used for sending electronic mail about every topic imaginable. The network pioneers were puzzled and not a little miffed to see newspaper reporters of all people with accounts on machines linked to the net. That was nearly as preposterous as the notion of walking into the campus chemistry lab and seeing a bunch of reporters wielding Bunsen burners and pipettes. Gradually, over a period of years, the original ARPANET network links were supplanted by faster data paths. And by 1990, the ARPANET ceased to exist as a separate entity, having been absorbed into the Internet. By one current estimate, several hundred thousand different computers are currently on the network, from supercomputers to personal computers. The best guess is that there are more than 4 million Internet users. This data highway already carries the work of scientists, students, soldiers, and businessmen, and many now argue that connecting it to millions of American homes and businesses will revolutionize the country with new business, educational, and entertainment services. But at first, the reason for the existence of networks was to carry out experiments that explored the reach and power of the networks themselves. In 1971, Bob Thomas, a scientist at Bolt, Baranek, and Newman, was working on distributed computing software. His group designed an air traffic control simulation that was intended to model different airports on different computers. The idea was to be able to move control of an airplane from one computer to another and tell all the other computers so that they would know the location of a particular aircraft had been changed. To do this, Thomas wrote a clever program whose mission was to crawl through the network and pop up on each screen, leaving the message, "I'm a creeper, catch me if you can." Sometime later, as word of the program grew within the early network community, other hackers wrote similar programs, some of which multiplied as they worked their way around the net. Creeper didn't reproduce itself, it simply moved. And others of which included Reaper programs that sought out and destroyed creepers. Writing such programs became a minor fad for a few months and then died out. In the early 1980s, two computer researchers at Xerox's Palo Alto Research Center started experimenting with programs they called worms that were able to run on many computers in a local area network. The ARPANET was a wide-area network, connecting computers over long distances. The term worm was taken from the book The Shockwave Rider, a science fiction classic written by John Brunner in 1975. It describes an authoritarian government that exercises power through an omnipotent computer network until a rebel programmer infests the network with a program called Tapeworm. In order to kill the worm, the government has to turn off the network, losing its power in the process. Brunner became a cult figure as the book swept through the worldwide community of science fiction readers. It had a strong influence on an emerging American computer underground, a loose affiliation of phone freaks and computer hackers in places like Silicon Valley and Cambridge, who appeared simultaneously with the development of the personal computer. John Schock and John Hepp, the Xerox researchers, were looking for a way to make shared computing power more widely and easily accessible over a local area network. They came up with 5 or 6 useful worms. One was called a town crier worm. Its job was to travel through the network posting announcements as it went. Another was a diagnostic worm. It was intended to hop from machine to machine, constantly checking to see if anything was amiss. Certainly, the most dramatic distributed program the two conceived was the vampire worm. Such a program, they suggested, would take advantage of the almost limitless free processing power in a network of computer workstations. After all, these machines spent many idle hours that could be harnessed for useful work. The Xerox vampire worm automatically turned itself on at night when people had gone home, setting to work on complex problems that required vast amounts of computing power. In the morning, when the computer's human owners returned to reclaim their machines, the vampire program would temporarily store the partial solution computed so far and shrink back to wait for the next evening. But early on, Schock and Hepp were also to learn of the potential dangers of worms. One night, a malfunctioning program went out of control on a local area network at the Palo Alto Research Center. In the morning, when scientists arrived, they found that computers throughout the building had crashed. They began to restart their systems, but soon found that each time they attempted to start a machine, the defective worm caused it to crash again immediately. The problem was that many computers were behind locked doors and couldn't be reached. Finally, they wrote a vaccine program that traveled through the network and electronically inoculated each computer in the network against the worm. The ARPANET was also a resource to Bell Laboratories scientist Ken Thompson, who used it for a computer security experiment. In the late 1970s, when Thompson was working on a paper about breaking password security, he used several network sites such as Harvard, MIT, Carnegie Mellon, and Berkeley, on which password files were publicly accessible or on which he had accounts with access to these files. His password cracking program was successful, and he discovered that he had inadvertently captured passwords used by some of the ARPANET's key administrators, people with accounts on many machines throughout the network. He tried the passwords and discovered they worked. In the hands of those whom Thompson and Bob Morris thought of as network bad guys, such a security flaw was dangerous. So Thompson sent mail to the people who owned the passwords to tell them about the problem.